Thanks very much. One of the lessons I've learned as an extension agronomist is not to be the one before lunch. So I don't think I met that today. We have a lot less experience with switchgrass than those of you in the Midwest. I've been working on it for the last 3 years. And we have some trials I'd like to share with you today and some thoughts about sustainability of switchgrass under a very different kind of scenario, a very high-yielding, intensive agricultural situation rather than extensive. Why are we considering biofuels? Well, there are a whole series of reasons. The world demand for petrochemicals, certainly the automobile use, world population, we're heading towards 9 billion. And there's this concept of not only the population increasing, but this idea of the Americans, or approximately 350 million people that make over $15,000 a year and like to consume things, as we do. And this predictions are that we will should see another two Americans being developed over the next 10 to 15 years. Climate change, a one-way experiment, the grand experiment with fairly important consequences, fuel security, and so forth. And I would not maintain that biofuels are certainly not the only alternative energy issue that we should look at. Conservation and terrestrial cycling of carbon, of course, being key issues. DOE mentions this concept of different generations of feedstocks for biofuels, the first generation being the starch-rich types and oil seeds. Second generation being waste products, so municipal waste, as well as stovers. And third generation being dedicated energy crops, such as switchgrass and other types of candidates, fast-growing dedicated tree crops, and of course, some interesting work on algae. This is the most frequent response when I mention irrigated biofuels is, you must be kidding. And California, if you're not familiar with our agriculture there, is a $37 billion food-producing, essentially powerhouse. We produce most of the fruits and vegetables, and fruits and nuts, some people would say, not the people, but the the crops in the United States. Is it a non-starter? And some people would claim that it would be a non-starter, but let's take a look at this. Is that correct? There's some key advantages to irrigated regions. One is the stability of production, very high yield potential. California in particular is an island of high energy demand, population, and environmental requirements. So that's one of the reasons that our fuel costs are so high. We have very stringent requirements in supply and demand on fuels. It reflects that. Marginal land and water, we have those even in places like California. Of course, the key negatives are water choices and water limitations, periodic drought, which is actually common to all agricultural regions, competition with food production, and of course, economic viability. I'd like to suggest that, you know, we're thinking in terms of a different paradigm than what the previous speaker talked about. The low input scenarios are use of marginal land that does not interfere with food production, minimizing inputs, looking at extensive systems, larger land-based requirement in general. And what we're looking at primarily is a high production scenario, which looks at maximizing productivity, integrated perhaps with food production, with a lower land-based requirement. What are the sustainability of irrigated regions in general? Well, many surface irrigation systems are at least theoretically completely renewable and sustainable if you can solve your drainage problems. Continual conflicts, of course, with other uses for water will always be there. There's a lot of people who feel that we shouldn't even be farming under irrigated conditions. And of course, most of the drought that we've seen in the last couple of years have been mostly regulatory, legal decisions in favor of fish habitat rather than agricultural uses for water. So it hasn't really, we've had droughts, of course, but that has not been the key issue with water use in agriculture. It's been mainly these conflicts between different uses. And so these are questions of beneficial use, which are broader, which affect all of agriculture, not just biofuels. Irrigation from aquifers are a little bit more problematic. We have the issue of energy impacts from pumps, the issue of slowly renewed water sources, that is fossil water, which I've seen in places like Saudi Arabia, versus rapidly renewed aquifers, and of course long-term salinity impacts, Let's remember, though, that these are issues common to all of agriculture. Where would the acreage in a place like California come from? Well, it would come from these crops here. We have about 12 million hectares of what we would call agronomic crops. The number one acreage crop in California is alfalfa, in spite of all the high-value crops that we have. And we have many other crops that would fall into this category. They're important to the growers that grow them. They use substantial amounts of water. And they are economically viable, at least some years. The sustainability criteria, I think we have to be careful, because right now in California, we not only have mandates for renewable fuels, but we have mandates for sustainability criteria for agricultural products. So we have to be careful about this. My contention is, let's not start with the answer. Let's keep asking the question and be real careful about it. There are likely to be multiple answers for different regions. My set of criteria are actually matching Ken Vogel's presented earlier. High biomass yields has got to be one of our key issues with sustainability. It reduces the cropping areas that are needed, efficiency in water use and resource use. It has lower impact on food production and high rates of conversion of solar energy to plant energy. Many of this will require new genetic innovations. Quality of conversion, high energy yield per unit weight of crop. We don't grow a million acres of the highest yielding forage in the world in alfalfa. We grow a million acres of the highest quality combined with the highest yield. And I think we should use that as a lesson for the issue of biofuels as well. We have to do the conversion in order to make it work. Differs between species and with management systems. And there are many factors, agronomic and others that would affect the quality conversion. Water use efficiency for us under irrigated conditions will be primary. You can visualize it this way. Under water-rich environments, you certainly would look at some species as being, or different varieties as being better this way. Perhaps under drought conditions, other species or varieties might be more interesting. And it depends on the, even within an irrigated region, as to whether you're on this side of that graph or the lower side. However, the water use sustainability criteria are much more complicated than that. It's really primarily a question of yield per unit water, primarily, but we have also a number of other issues. What is the flexibility of water use? How do we cope with water deficits, which will occur either through transfers to other uses or regulatory types of restrictions? Can we look at partial season irrigation, timing of water use of seasonal rains as many parts of our system? So the ET itself is interesting, but it's not the primary issue with regards to water use under irrigated conditions. We also have to look very carefully at utilizing waste waters, of which we have substantial portions in our region, such as municipal and dairy waste. Nitrogen fertilizer requirement is one of the primary fossil fuel requirements of grassy crops. Has a significant economic impact as well as a fuel impact, and it has a secondary impact on food grains. So that's obviously an important criteria. What about management of biological risk? High resistance to stress and pathogens and weeds, adaptation to difficult soils. We've faced this issue of an invasive species. We looked very briefly, not very long, at Arundo donax, which is a very invasive species in the riparian areas in California. Johnson grass and other examples. Switchgrass was actually listed as an invasive species in California, was recently taken off the list, but it is something we're watching. We have a research project at UC Davis to examine the invasive characteristics of both switchgrass and miscanthus. What about infrastructure support? Developed seed industry. This is where some of our typical forages and crops might have a leg up on some of the newer crops like miscanthus. And so this is clearly an issue, but could be corrected over time. What is the impact on food production, competition for land and water? What is a secondary impact on fertilizer? Forages and grains, can we integrate biofuels with grain and forage production is really an important question. and look for integrated food and fuel producing systems. I think particularly for our environment, I would emphasize the idea of the multiple use scenario. That is, most successful crops have had multiple markets for either grain and stover in some cases, sugar, alcohol. And in case of forages, what about using forages for both cellulosic and forage use? We have a tremendous demand in our state for forages. We have 1.8 million dairy cows and about a third of that in beef cows. Can we envision a combination of forage and cellulosic production systems? For example, a $100 a ton product that's high yielding on the 10 to 18 tons per acre yield level that can be fractionated somehow, either by cutting schedule or other forms of fractionation, into a high quality forage and a lower priced, high fiber forage to make it more economically viable for farmers. Because essentially, forages and grains are going to be those crops with which an irrigated biofuel would compete in our environment. So you have to make it economically viable. It produces two results. It creates a higher quality product from a coarser forage, and it produces two income streams. And it also perhaps could isolate N-containing compounds from the cellulosic compounds, at least to some degree. And this could occur through either cutting schedules or post-harvest separation of leaf and stem material. Going on with some of these criteria, what about ecosystem services? Sequester additional soil carbon. These were touched on earlier. Reducing air pollution potential, conserving soil, water, and other resources, and providing wildlife habitat. I'm not so sure whether all of these are conducive to complete modeling exercises that we've heard this morning. Perhaps they are, because so many different ecosystem services are more complex than what we would think about originally. And that's the reason for my question about the biodiversity of alfalfa fields. We've seen huge amounts of insects in alfalfa fields, very few in our switchgrass plots, for example. And that's a form of biodiversity. We see wildlife benefits of crops such as rice and alfalfa in our environment, irrigated pasture currently, and those already provide tremendous services. And I believe that switchgrass and other grassy forages would also provide tremendous kinds of services that way, particularly when you ask the question, as compared with what? And we have, of course, a lot of acres of other types of perennial crops such as grapes and orchards that don't have as many of these kinds of characteristics. What are the advantages of perennials? They have very high yields. They use the full growing season. They, in terms of sunlight capture, they're much more efficient than many times than annuals. Reduced runoff from nutrient losses and irrigation runoff. Reduced soil erosion. The deep and extensive root system of perennials results in a more efficient water use and less watering past the root zone, which is frequently a problem with high or shallow-rooted short-term crops such as lettuce and tomato. Improved soil tilth and carbon sequestration are all important parts of perennial systems. What are the disadvantages of perennials? Well, it's not easy to change your mind. It's probably the big disadvantage. This is true of high-value perennials as well. The we have a number of orchards that people plant with certain varieties of say plums and so forth, and when the markets disappear, it's very difficult for those farmers to figure out how to rotate then to another crop. So lack of flexibility. And what about water flexibility? Do you have water flexibility? During the last 2 years of drought, the main beneficiaries of those areas where we had reduced water were safflower and wheat. Why? Because they had greater flexibility in water use, not because they were necessarily the highest yield, highest income crops. And so these are, and remember that annual C4 plants are also very highly productive. We've conducted switchgrass trials throughout California, starting in Tule Lake near the Oregon border, Davis, California, Fresno County, and the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, and El Centro. The dots here show you the alfalfa acreage, which shows kind of where the major agricultural zones. The Central Valley is the major agricultural area of California. So these were the locations. This was in cooperation with Ceres company. We planted in June and July. We used 10 varieties. We irrigated to an estimated ETO for each site or slightly above, and we gave it a moderate amount of N applications at least our judgment, from what it might require. Here are the year one yields from 2007, ranging from the southern site is on the right here, and the northern site is on the left. Tule Lake did actually pretty well, and Davis did pretty well the first year, between, say, 3 and 6 tons per acre. That's 11 to 18 megagrams. Somewhat more modest yields at the desert station that was established a little later. In 2008, the first production year, the northern site, we had the southern varieties freeze out at this site, which kind of puzzled me a little bit, because California shouldn't be colder than Texas or Oklahoma, where I think most of these are from. So we had some tremendous problems with freezing out. I think it was a kind of an anomaly, perhaps, of the stand establishment process. But the remaining varieties of the northern adapted lines, Trailblazer is here, were on the order of, say, 9 to 11 megagrams per hectare. Davis 2008 were much higher yield levels in a two-cut system. The northernmost site was a one-cut system. We had two-cut systems in the Central Valley locations and a three-cut system in the most southern location. And you can see the first cut, the first year, we actually cut later than perhaps we should have, but we cut in, say, the first harvest was in July, and so last harvest was in October. And yields ranged between approximately, say, 14 to 20 megagrams per hectare. Fresno County gave us much higher yield levels, which resulted in yields up to about 40 megagrams per hectare, it's of the best adapted lines. And again, we see a better success of the southern lines in the Central Valley as we go further south, which should be of no surprise. The El Centro site gave us similar maximum yield levels of up to about 20 metric tons per hectare, with some of the northern adapted lines really falling apart as you go further south. So essentially, we had a range of yield levels between north and south of between 9 megagrams and 40 under fully irrigated conditions. In 2009, we actually believe that we'll have a little bit higher yields than that, or at least maintain the same yield level at many of the locations. We only have three of the locations here, Davis, Fresno, and El Centro. And this was the first cut yields of between, say, on the well-adapted lines, 13 and about 18 metric tons per hectare on the first cut yields. And this is the only summary of the total yields, because everything else is in the field practically. So the Davis yields were somewhere around 26 metric tons per hectare to 30 metric tons per hectare. So these are very high yielding crops in California's environment. Now, I have to emphasize that these are good soils under fully irrigated conditions, and so it's a very different scenario than what was presented before. Now, I want to also point out that we decided to bring up our first harvest date in the second year, which I think was the good. We have a lot of questions about how to manage this crop, which we haven't even begun to really answer fully. But we started with a June harvest, which I think is probably a better strategy for this kind of crop. We've done some work on nitrogen with applied nitrogen at the different locations, and began to see a response in 2008. 2009, we're seeing much more dramatic response at all of our locations. So it's taken some time to see this kind of response. And it's something that we want to watch carefully to make sure we're not buying ourselves some big troubles. These are just some photographs of the plots. You can see some very nice segregation between the lines at the different locations. This was just about a week ago with 40 mile an hour winds. I was very pleased that it didn't go down entirely. I think it. We did have a lot of lodging in when we left. Let the cutting schedule go too late. That was one of the problems that we've been having, but we've changed that around a little bit. Theoretical ethanol yields, and I'm not sure if I believe any of this, but I've used the Department of Energy calculations from some data that we have for quality from El Centro and calculated out some theoretical yields of, say, between 900 and about 1,700 gallons per acre, depending upon the location. So these are fairly high theoretical ethanol yields. This was at 101 gallons per ton, which is probably a little too high. I think probably practical yields are much less than that. But, of course, that's yet to be determined. In summary, in our work that we've done so far, Switchgrass so far fulfills several of these sustainability criteria. We have questions about other aspects. By definition, you know, I would say that irrigated agriculture is not low input. Once you start irrigating, you have to rethink your system to some degree, and it requires a different strategy. High yields are certainly a requirement under these kinds of conditions to minimize cost and maximize value, to look at ecosystem services in a broad sense. And I wanted to dwell on irrigation requirement because we don't know what the irrigation requirement of switchgrass is. We irrigated at ETO. We think that it's probably slightly less than alfalfa if you look at ET, but that's actually not the most important question. The most important question is not what a fully irrigated, that's what ET is, a fully irrigated, full canopy crop. How much water would that require? The question is more important to ask is, can we irrigate this crop with less than full irrigation and still produce reasonably economic yields? For example, a single cut or an early dry down, going from, say, 4 acre feet, which is our alfalfa requirement, down to 2 acre feet, can we still produce very, very high yielding crops? Saline conditions and reuse of wastewater. And the other key issue is probably multiple use scenarios as forage and biofuels and looking at economic viability and flexibility of the crop given the tremendous demand for forages that we have in our region. And again, it's sort of keep asking these kinds of questions, at least I've been over the years. So this is actually Sudan grass and alfalfa hay being grown down near Mexico, much of which, or at least a substantial portion of which, is actually exported to Japan and Korea. And so the question is, can some of this be used for an economic biofuel system? Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. We have a question for Dan.
In addition to irrigation, how much nitrogen fertilizer do you have there for your high input?
We're in the process of measuring the effect of nitrogen on the productivity of switchgrass. In these trials, we applied approximately 150 to 200 pounds, that is kilograms per hectare, at the different locations. We adjusted that for the expected yield level at, say, Tule Lake versus Davis or the further south. So we tried to adjust that and make decisions based upon our expected yield level. Crop removal of nitrogen is well over, say, 150 to 200 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So we were trying to minimize nitrogen impacts, but still not. We wanted to see the genetic potential of the crop, so we didn't want to starve the crop either. The crop removal? Yes, we have some data on nitrogen removal rates and so forth. Yeah, it's going to be about one. It's actually in some cases less than 1%. Yeah, but yeah, it's going to be around 1%. Yeah, depends on how much leaves are recovered actually to some degree.
How much is the total ET?
The total ET? Okay, we did not measure ET. The ETO for those, it depends on where, because the northern sites would have a much lower ETO. And I'm going to have to say that in not in millimeters per, I'm going to have to say in acre feet per acre. But acre feet is approximately 2.5 acre feet in Tule Lake, approximately almost, well, it's over about 3.5 acre feet per acre in Davis, and 4 acre feet per acre in Fresno, and probably up to about 6 acre feet, 5.5 to 6 acre feet per acre in El Centro, which is near Mexico. That's a true desert condition. So we have Mediterranean, we have mountain climates, and we have desert conditions under these.
For
experimental plots? Well, that's one of the things about switchgrass that's kind of appealing, because we believe that it can be harvested with typical haying equipment. I think you found that in your studies. Miscanthus, I have a lot of doubts about, but we'll find out. I don't know, maybe some other people know about this. We used Carter harvesters and experimental harvesters in these plots and drove very slowly. No, there's some varieties had substantial seed production, depending upon the area, had some seed production, which is one of the reasons, and in fact, some areas we were concerned about the issue of invasiveness, because we had substantial seed production. It actually gets back to this cutting schedule. We have a lot to learn about the cutting schedule impacts under a high-yielding environment like this. Certainly, at Tule Lake, we've made a decision that it's a single-cut system, and I think we've made the right choice that it's a two-cut system in our Mediterranean areas and probably also our desert areas, which is also important to reduce cost, too. You don't want to have frequent cuts. As we do, we have 7 to 10 cuttings with alfalfa, so that's a high-cost harvesting system.